Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Michael Lawler. I'm counsel for Willie Mitchell. I am going to be arguing Issue 5 in our brief, which deals with the exclusion of a defense witness by the name of Herb Lynch. It is the position of Mr. Mitchell that the lower court, erred in forcing a choice by Mr. Mitchell between unseating an unbiased juror calling a vital defense witness.
But he didn't make the choice, though. I mean, I thought that was handled skillfully by defense counsel. Didn't he make the choice?
There was certainly a debate. Perhaps choice is the wrong word. There was a debate by the court and all of the parties, really, about what was the best interest for all parties in proceeding, whether or not to exclude the juror or to exclude the witness. It was the position of Mr. Mitchell, of course, that if that was the choice that had to be made, the juror should be excluded and the witness should be permitted to be called. It is nonetheless, despite that, that there was no choice that needed to be made in this case.
Didn't the government agree to stipulate that testimony?
Your Honor, the government did agree to enter into a stipulation, but it was our position in the lower court that this was not the testimony that this witness could have and would have provided was not such that it could be stipulated to. There was meat on the bone, if you will, that we wanted the jury to hear from the witness about not just where Mr. Mitchell was during this time, but what he was doing during this time.
But it seems as though a fair amount of effort was made to accommodate both concerns.
I agree that the judge below admonished us, if you will, suggested to us that a stipulation could be worked out. And ultimately, the government did agree. There was no dispute that Mr. Mitchell was at, for example, the Hickey School from date X until date Y. However, it was our contention throughout the course of the trial that what the government had charged here wasn't what they proved, that this wasn't a racketeering enterprise, A, and it wasn't a singular conspiracy, B. And therefore, what the defendant was doing during a period of this time, not just that he was at the school, but the activities that he was engaged in during this time for an extended period of time, and what he did after when Coach Lynch maintained contact with him.
But you also introduced other witnesses who testified. You introduced, in essence, replacement witnesses, did you not, who testified as to Mitchell's activities at the Hickey School?
I wouldn't agree that we called a replacement witness. We called another witness who testified that when Mr. Mitchell was at a community college in New York, he was on the football team and he was engaged in activities that would suggest that he wasn't at that time at least involved in a criminal conspiracy. Coach Lynch would have added to that testimony, we think, in more depth over a greater period of time. In a different period of time, what Mr. Mitchell was doing at the Hickey School, as I said, from date X to date Y, a different period of time than the other witness that we called. But also beyond that, Mr. Lynch and Mr. Mitchell maintained a relationship because of the nature of their relationship when Mr. Mitchell went away to college. And, Your Honor, as I indicated, I think the real issue here is that, as I said, there need not have been, there was no choice to be had here. The juror was voir dired by the court. The juror did indicate that he knew Coach Lynch, and there was a relationship between the coach and the juror's son, but notwithstanding that, he did say, number one, I can avoid contact with Coach Lynch, and number two, it won't affect my ability to be fair.
I thought he indicated that his son interacted, that there was interaction between Coach Lynch and his son on, if not a daily basis, then something approximating a daily basis or approaching a daily basis, and that avoiding that conflict or contact would be difficult and that it would be a difficult family decision to make.
I think there were layers to it, and I think the court's characterization of what the juror said is correct. But I believe that the juror said, although the son would maintain a relationship with the coach because finances had been provided for the services that the coach was providing to the son, they didn't want to give up that money, that the son would continue to go to the coaching sessions, but that the juror could avoid, fine, he would drop off the son, if you will, but there wouldn't be direct contact between him and the coach. And alternatively, even if he saw the coach, that it wouldn't affect his ability to be a fair juror. And therefore, as I said, no choice really needed to be made here. I see that my time is up. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Lowell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Flannery.
Morning. May it please the court. My name is Paul Flannery, and I'm counsel for appellant Shelton Harris. I'd like to discuss with the court this morning the common issue, which is issue number 3 in our brief, that the district court improperly allowed the government in this case to use the appellant's pro se legal strategy against them as evidence in support of a conspiracy in this case. The government prosecutors in their closing argument told the jury that there has been very rarely a better example of four human beings getting together and acting as a team. That can be found in the record at JA 2087. And that reference was not a reference to any of the murder schemes in this case. It wasn't a reference to any plan or meeting of drug dealing among the appellants. What that reference was to the appellant's pro se legal strategy that they employed in this case. And the government prosecutors went farther than that, and they also told the jury that it was an important piece of evidence in terms of assessing all of the concerted conduct that the government put on in this case. And in a 3-month trial with the volumes of evidence that the government has taken pains to point out in their brief, they told the jury that they isolated for the jury one example that they could look to demonstrate the concerted conduct among these four appellants, where otherwise there was not a single piece of evidence that was put forward, at least with respect to Shelton Harris, where the government could demonstrate for the jury that these four appellants were acting in concert with one another. And although the government can characterize what the appellants did perhaps as disruptive and maybe even obstructive, they cannot change the fundamental fact that what the appellants did in this case was in furtherance of what they understood to be a misguided legal strategy. And even the district court, Judge Davis, when he drafted an opinion on this very issue, and even the case agent, the government's own case agent, when he testified and summarized the appellant's conduct, they both recognized that it was questioning the jurisdiction of the court. Detective Benson testified that the court can't have jurisdiction over them as flesh and blood men. Now, no one questions that the appellants did not have the right to abuse the dignity of the courtroom, but that doesn't mean that the government had the right to turn around and criminalize that conduct and use it against them as evidence. This sets a very dangerous precedent. Even Judge Davis recognized at trial that this placed the entire trial, the government's conduct here, this alone, placed the entire trial in uncharted territory. We've never been here before. And it wasn't just the appellant's courtroom conduct that the government attempted to use against them. It was also the filing of their pro se pleadings. Those pro se pleadings were no different than if the appellants had gotten together and researched the law on RICO and drafted an identical motion that they presented to the court to dismiss the indictment in this case, and allowing the government to be the final arbiter of what's disruptive and what is an effort to thwart prosecution is dangerous. Not everything that co-defendants do when tried together is a crime. And the chilling effect that this had on the appellant's Sixth Amendment and Fifth Amendment rights to fundamental fairness in criminal proceedings was evident. In fact, in this case...
How was the government the final arbiter of it?
Well, it's interesting that in this case, the initial indictment...
I'm just asking you, how was the government the final arbiter of it?
Because the jury was never forced to come to a conclusion the way that the allegations were placed in the indictment, Your Honor. The jury was never forced to make any finding that there was actually any obstruction of justice, because the conduct was never charged as a predicate act, although it could have been. It was simply put in as an amorphous additional purpose of what at that time was referred to as the Mitchell Organization. And with that allegation, which it's notable that it didn't come in, the government did not seek that superseding indictment until Judge Davis had actually suggested.
How were they the final arbiter of it? Because they argued it to the jury?
Because they sought those allegations in the indictment that it was disruptive courtroom proceeding in an effort to thwart prosecution. The jury was allowed then to hear that evidence, but there was no decision, no finding was ever made that there was actually one, disruptive conduct, or two, that it was an act of obstruction, because it was never charged as a predicate act.
Help me understand the nature of the wrong that you're alleging. It doesn't appear to me that the evidence in that regard was used as evidence of guilt, but as an indication of the acting in concert piece. Here is an example of these individuals acting in concert in furtherance. I mean, help me understand.
Yeah, sure. And I think I think the government's own words in their closing argument can draw that point out, because the government told the jury that this evidence that we're discussing, the conduct that was carried out in connection with this pro se legal defense, they characterized it as, quote, powerful evidence that reflects the concerted, conspiratorial, enterprise nature of the defendant's activities in general. That can be found at the record at 2088 to 2089.
But that's not comment on content. That's just comment on actions. Or they're not commenting on the legal principle being advocated. It's just concerted action that they're pointing out to the jury.
That's correct. But whether they were commenting, even if they, I don't see how it adds anything if they do comment even on the legal action. In fact, they actually pointed out for the jury at one point that they drew a distinction that you can feel free to file things in court, but what the defendants did here was evidence of a crime because of the manner in which they did it. It wasn't simply just the conduct that they were attempting to criminalize, and that's, I think, what's important.
But I ask you the same question. Who's the final arbiter of how that action is interpreted? Is it the government or is it the jury? You said the government became the final arbiter. You haven't answered my question. How are they the final arbiter? They just suggested that to the jury, didn't they?
That's correct. They suggested it to the jury.
How then are they the final arbiter?
Well, perhaps I should retract then that my statement as the final arbiter. They shouldn't have been the first arbiter. They should not have been allowed to even bring that evidence before the jury, because if what the government is allowed to do here is permitted, what the government is given the keys to is to make a determination as to what they deem to be an effort to
thwart. You can do that in jury argument. You do that in jury argument all the time. Both sides do. You might want to say it's an improper comment, but that whole bit about arbiter, I don't see whether that has anything to do with anything. Are you the arbiter of some conclusion that you draw and suggest to the jury, or is that just your suggestion on the evidence, if it's proper, for the jury to be the final arbiter? I don't understand that whole concept of how the government's the final arbiter any more than you're the final arbiter of an argument off the evidence that you make to the jury.
I think maybe what perhaps I should suggest is the arbiter as to going back and seeking that superseding indictment, putting those allegations in the indictment, which is based on conduct that was carried out in furtherance of the legal defense. And the reason I use the term arbiter is because the government obviously made that decision to go back, seek that superseding indictment, put those allegations in there. What Judge Davis's comment was then, and it was important to him in determining that he couldn't then preclude the government from introducing that evidence and attempting to prove it, as he said, I'm hamstrung because it's in the indictment.
Thank you very much.
So, I see that my time is up, so if there's no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flannery. Mr. Crowe?
Thank you, Chief Judge Traxler. May it please the Court. My name is Thomas Crowe. I represent Shelley Wayne Martin in this appeal. We raised two issues which were specific to Mr. Martin. I would like to address just one of them, and that is our contention that the District Court erred in refusing to give our requested instruction that in order for an individual to be convicted of a RICO conspiracy, he had to agree that either he or another conspirator would have committed at least two of the racketeering acts. The fundamentals are, I think, crystal clear. Court doesn't need much discussion of them. And a conspiracy is an agreement to the commission of a crime. The party who is part of the conspiracy has to either agree or intend that each of the elements of the substantive crime will be committed. An element of the substantive RICO crime is a pattern of racketeering activity, although that's a very complicated matter. One of the fundamentals is that there has to be at least two racketeering acts committed for there to be a substantive crime. And in this case, we have an indictment which was terribly specific and indeed purported to list an exclusive set of nine racketeering acts. I've already gone over the instruction that we've requested. The government argues, I think somewhat weakly, that the Supreme Court's 1997 Salinas decision was to the contrary because it did not require the instruction we requested to be given. Of course, that instruction was not an issue in the case. As we further point out, we think that in Salinas, the court really said the same thing that we are saying. They cited with approval the 1962 provision of the Model Penal Code. In fact, they even quoted the portion which said that the person must have agreed with such other persons or persons that one or more of them will engage in the conduct which constitutes the crime. And indeed, the conduct which constitutes the crime in this instance is the commission of two racketeering acts. Nowhere did the district court tell the jury that it had to come to that conclusion. The instructions went on for pages, as one would expect with a case of this length and complexity. The closest the judge came was on a couple of occasions when he said that the defendant must have participated in some manner. And we contend that this in some manner minimization was sprinkled throughout all of the instructions in the achievement of the overall objectives of the conspiracy, and that the conspiracy either that there were committed or that there were intended to be committed two racketeering acts. What he did not tell the jury was that they had to conclude that Mr. Martin, in fact, had agreed to the commission of two racketeering acts. As our brief states at some length, we think that the proof of the pudding in here is the jury's acquittals of Mr. Martin on all five of the substantive counts of which he was charged. That there was Mr. Martin was only alleged to have been involved in the murders of two persons, the Weiss brothers. He was acquitted of participation in their murders as vicar murders under the court's instruction as a principal, as an aider and abettor, and indeed as a conspirator, because the judge gave, at the government's request, the Pinkerton instruction that an individual who was part of a conspiracy, must be held liable for the substantive crime itself. And there were three related, there were also, in addition to that, three related gun charges which dealt with the murder and the robbery. The substantive crimes are very much mirrored, in this case, of the racketeering acts. And what we say is that essentially that what the jury came back with was its firm conclusion that Mr. Martin, in this case, was simply not involved in any of the racketeering acts in any fashion. We think that the special verdict form was essentially a special verdict on that. Finally, and I see that I have 7 seconds left, we also think that in the unusual circumstances of this case, that the remedy should not be a remand to the district court, but that the court should enter judgments of acquittal, because we think that the collateral estoppel wing of double jeopardy already settles the matter, and that this court should so conclude.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Crowe. Mr. Curlin?
Good morning, members of the panel. Adam Curland representing Sean Gardner. I want to make a couple comments on issues 11, 12, and a little bit ambitious if there's time, a few comments on kind of a hybrid of issues 13 and 15. With respect to the evidence against Gardner, it really boils down to this. There was no evidence that he was tied to Shakedown. That's uncontroverted. The issue is, what's the legal significance of that? He was not involved in any of the double murders. He wasn't charged in the first set of double murders, and he was acquitted on the other double murders. So his involvement really deals with the third murder, the Spence homicide, and whether or not it was done or his actions were done, undertaken to maintain or increase his position in the enterprise. And that becomes kind of a critical issue with respect to the government's key witness on that count, James Montgomery, testified at the Gardner State trial, and the critical issue, which we feel is of constitutional dimension and requires reversal, is that Gardner should have been able to introduce to the jury, as relevant as part of Montgomery's cross-examination, that Montgomery testified successfully in Gardner's state court trial to a particular version of events and convinced an earlier jury beyond a reasonable doubt of version X, let's say. And in this trial, on two subtle but critical points, he is now trying to convince another jury beyond a reasonable doubt of a totally different version. And it is absolutely essential to make that argument that the jury be made aware that Montgomery testified successfully, not in an earlier proceeding or not in an earlier trial of which the result isn't known, but that he testified successfully and received a huge sentencing benefit, and now he's testifying, trying to convince another jury beyond a reasonable doubt of a different version of events. And members of the panel, the two points, it's complex, but it really boils down to two critical aspects of the testimony that were much different in the state trial and in the federal trial, and that had to do with the critical federal element of whether or not Gardner's involvement in the Spence homicide was undertaken to maintain or increase his position. And the government went to great lengths to get from Montgomery a kind of a tie that didn't exist in his state court testimony. In his state court testimony, he basically says that this is a separate thing, not related to anything. I recruit Aaron Holly first. Holly gets Gardner. Gardner wants to be involved in this because he's lost a couple of $1,000. He's taken a fall. He needs the money. That's the state court testimony, which we wanted to present as state court testimony that was successful in the sense that Montgomery convinced an earlier jury beyond reasonable doubt. At the federal trial, they need to show that this separate murder, which is very separate, it's not related to any of the other defendants, no other defendant in this case is substantively charged in the Spence homicide. And the government's theory is, wait a minute, the robbery was undertaken to get legal fees to help pay for the other defendants, which makes it kind of part of the enterprise. And the other issue had to do with that the robbery of Spence was sort of plan B, a backup plan, when the Goose homicide plan didn't work out. That testimony that Montgomery did at the federal trial was nowhere to be seen in the state trial. So these were, and those were the critical points that made this otherwise hanging Spence homicide supposedly charged in the indictment. It comes at a time and a place when all the other defendants are incarcerated except for one. It really, if you read the indictment, it really doesn't tie together at all. And so the government was really grasping with respect to that.
I'm a little bit unclear about your argument and in your brief, too. It was not in the brief, too. Gardner was allowed, Montgomery testified, and the court allowed Gardner to present evidence that Montgomery had testified against Gardner in prior proceedings.
Judge Duncan, that's not quite accurate. What happened was, and this was litigated over the course of years with respect to pre-trial proceedings and then a trial. Judge Davis originally first said, going back and forth, that we would be permitted to do this. Then the judge changed his mind. Then he came up with all sorts of unconstitutional conditions saying, well, you can do this only if Gardner assents on the record. But on the critical point that you're inquiring on, finally the judge said, okay, Mr. Curl and Mr. Coburn, you've convinced me that we don't have to limit it to prior proceedings. I'll let you say he testified at an earlier trial, but I'm still not going to let you tell the jury the results of the trial.
The result, and that was really what I said. I said he was allowed to testify as to another proceeding. What he was prohibited from doing was, as I recall, was introducing the result of that prior proceeding, correct?
Yes, Judge, but
okay, and what I really don't understand is why it wouldn't be enough that Gardner and Montgomery, two co-conspirators, worked together on a murder to make it part of a conspiracy. I don't see the critical disconnect that
I understand. Judge, it isn't that I'm not challenging that there's a conspiratorial connection between Gardner and Montgomery. But the critical thing is with respect to the federal charge, the federal charge requires not just conspiracy, but that the Spence murder be undertaken by Gardner to maintain or increase his position in this amorphous count one enterprise that the government charged. So it isn't that there's a conspiracy between Gardner and Montgomery. That's established. We're not contesting that. The argument is consistent with the federal charges. The specific element of is that this murder was not related to maintaining or increasing one's position in the enterprise. And that's why it's critical for the jury to have been told not only did Montgomery testify differently in an earlier trial, but he convinced, and this was the argument that we were not able to make, that he convinced an earlier jury beyond a reasonable doubt of version A that had no connection with any other larger enterprise, and now he's trying to convince the second jury of a substantially different version of events. Because this Spence homicide is simply not undertaken to maintain or increase Gardner's position in the enterprise. So the conspiracy is different from the element of whether or not it was done in furtherance of the charged enterprise.
I think we're missing
it. Out of time? I guess I'm not going to get to my other points.
That's not.
Well, you got 2 more minutes. I mean, you have 2 minutes in reply if you want to get to that then.
Can I take a
sure.
couple seconds?
Sure, 2 minutes now.
Well, I won't use all of it. I just want to make one point with respect to the government's closing argument, which is issue 12. The court, in this particular case, rather, the government simply misstates the record and makes outrageous statements saying that if this case is when it's done, the state isn't going to do anything. That was a misstatement of the record. It was not a proper response. The brief goes through all the detail, but the comments that I made in closing argument were very narrowly tailored to arguing a legitimate jury instruction that the court gave, and it was simply a totally wrong argument by the government, which was extremely prejudicial. The rest of it is set forth fairly substantially in the briefs, so I hope I still have a minute and a half or so for the rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Curlin. Mr. Harding.
Chief Judge Traxler, my name is Robert Harding. I was the lead counsel in the trial, in this case, U.S. v. Willie Mitchell. I want to begin, if I may, with Mr. Crow's argument about the jury instruction that he requested. The fundamental problem with his proposed jury instruction was that it called for the jurors to decide whether the defendant had committed two predicate acts or agreed to commit two predicate acts. That is erroneous by itself. That is not a correct instruction because RICO penalizes participation in a course of conduct, not committing predicate acts. RICO penalizes people who participate in the affairs of an enterprise through a pattern of racketeering activity. And it's true that the pattern of racketeering activity needs to include at least two racketeering acts, but it's not true, as Mr. Crow's own cases say, that a defendant has to have committed or agreed to commit two of the predicate acts. That's because the essence of RICO is participating in a course of conduct and not committing racketeering acts. The instruction that Judge Davis gave
essentially covered, didn't it essentially, as I read it, at least at 2158, cover that point?
Yes, I'm at 2169. He says,
and there, yeah,
that the government must prove that the defendant committed, that the defendant participated in some manner in the achievement of the overall objectives of the conspiracy, and that the conspiracy involved or would have involved the commission of two predicate acts. The government is not required to prove either that the defendant agreed to commit two racketeering acts or that he actually committed two racketeering acts, although you may conclude that he agreed to participate in the conduct of the enterprise through proof that he agreed to commit or actually committed racketeering acts. So Mr. Crow's instruction was incorporated in the sense that if you agreed to the commission of two racketeering acts, the jury can certainly consider that as evidence of what the jury needs to find. But what the jury needs to find is participation in a course of conduct, participation in the achievement of the overall objectives of the conspiracy. And that is fundamental to RICO law, and it is repeated over and over again in the cases that defendant cites himself in his reply brief. For example, Pisonia, the Second Circuit case, has a very brief statement along these lines. In short, a RICO conspiracy is never simply an agreement to commit specified predicate acts that allegedly form a pattern of racketeering, nor is it merely an agreement to join in a particular enterprise. Rather, it is an agreement to conduct or to participate in the conduct of a charged enterprise's affairs through a pattern of racketeering activity. That's what was wrong with Mr. Crow's instruction, and the court gave a correct instruction from Sand and Siffert, which was based on Salinas and the other cases that Mr. Crow himself cites. I think Mr. Crow simply misread the cases, because as soon as he gets to the point where the courts explained that the conspiracy had to have involved at least two overt acts, Mr. Crow reads that to mean that you have to have agreed to two overt acts. He reads these opinions as supporting his point of view, and he fails to read on and discover that, in fact, you don't have to have agreed to commit two racketeering acts. That's my interpretation of the defense confusion on this issue. If I may, I'll go now back to the issues that were raised previously, starting with Coach Lynch. I want to stress that the reply brief and defense argument here today takes a rather different approach toward this witness than the defense counsel were taking during the trial. In trial, the attorneys for Mr. Mitchell minimized the importance of Coach Lynch. They said he was there only to testify about the limited time periods that Mitchell was in the Hickey School. This is at the joint appendix at page 819, 820. And the whole thrust of Ms. Rhodes's proffer at that point, the judge had requested a truly detailed proffer, and Ms. Rhodes tried to provide one, and it boiled down simply to saying that Mitchell was at the Hickey School on certain dates, and she also said that she wanted Coach Lynch to testify about the sorts of things he did at the
I thought she also said that we don't have many witnesses, and so the few we've got are very important, and because of his standing in the community, you know, we consider him very important.
Yes, and then they called these replacement witnesses. They alerted the court early on that they were trying to get replacement witnesses. They got a different football coach from a community college where Mr. Mitchell played football to testify, and they got an investigator.
Well, of course they had to, because they were faced with losing Lynch. I mean, they wanted to make their point. They had to, you know, if they can't use Coach Lynch, they got to go get somebody to make this point. And I don't know the fact that they go and get somebody else's means that Coach Lynch wasn't important.
Well, they insisted themselves that Coach Lynch was purely an alibi witness. And for a time period when the government had no evidence of criminal activity.
What do you mean by alibi witness?
That he could say where Mitchell was at certain points of time during the day, during a period of a few months in 1995-96.
And did that contradict any specific testimony the government offered?
No, Your Honors.
Well, that's not alibi witness then. Not, I mean, alibi evidence.
They insisted it was an alibi witness. We agree that we had no evidence of criminal conduct during that period. So in that sense, he was not an alibi witness because he provided no excuse for what Mitchell was doing during the time period when crimes were going on. I'd also like to point out, if I may, in Joint Appendix page 1849, Judge Davis actually offered to admit an affidavit about Lynch's testimony if the government declined the stipulation that the court was trying to get defense counsel to agree to. Defense counsel did not take the court up on that. Defense counsel never filed a written proffer of what Lynch's testimony was going to be, and they waited until the very end of the trial, November 7th, the end of the government's case in the trial, to backed down from their position that they would. They wanted both the juror and Coach Lynn.
But if I was a defense lawyer, I'd have done the exact same thing. I am not going to be forced into withdrawing one of my witnesses that I consider important. I'd have done the exact same thing.
Well, they wound up getting exactly what they wanted. So
no, they didn't. Their witness didn't testify.
Well, they got the evidence in that the witness was going to testify about. They got it in through an investigator, another football coach, and through the government's stipulation as to when Mitchell was at the Hickey School. The investigator testified about the sorts of things Mitchell was doing at the Hickey School when he was there.
It sounds like to me you're arguing that it was harmless.
I am arguing that
if it was error, it was harmless.
If it was error, it was certainly harmless error, because as Judge Davis noted over and over again from the beginning, this witness was completely inconsequential in the trial, and that underlay his decision. He waited until the end to rule on it because he wanted to make sure the defense was going to get in the evidence that Lynch offered. But having assured himself of that, he felt comfortable in refusing to allow Lynch to testify and keeping the juror whom all of the defendants wanted. It's very important here that all four of the defendants were adamant that the juror should stay. They thought he was an important part of their hope for prevailing in the case. And so the judge was whipsawed, in other words, on this one. But,
well, there's no doubt he was put between a rock and a hard place.
Right.
But what do you do? Let the juror go that everybody else wants, or do you deprive a defendant of his witness?
Well, I think that if it were a significant witness with evidence about that related to the crimes charged against Mitchell, then Judge Davis would have been wrong to prevent the witness from testifying. But he was quite clear, and defense counsel encouraged him to believe this, that Lynch had no relevant testimony, no important, significant testimony, apart from what was coming in other ways. So I believe that Judge Davis made the right decision. On the issue of...
Can you at some point address the issue of Gardner's ability to impeach Montgomery?
Okay. I'll go directly to that.
I don't want to preempt your order, but at some point I would appreciate it if you would speak to that. Because the argument... I'm still having difficulty with that argument.
Okay. As Your Honor noted... the judge offered to allow defense counsel to bring out the fact that Montgomery had testified in a previous trial before a jury, in a jury trial. He just wasn't going to allow in the results of that trial and the fact that Gardner had gotten a life sentence as a result of that trial. He wanted to keep out the verdict and the punishment. That is exactly what the Sixth Circuit did in the Second Circuit did in the Giovanelli case. Defense counsel ignore that case in their reply brief and have ignored it here today, but that is a case that is as close to on point as we can find in the case law. The court there, the district court, allowed the defense attorneys to question the witness about the fact that the witness had testified in a prior jury trial. But he refused because it was too prejudicial and irrelevant to allow the verdict or the punishment to come into evidence. That's a key point that runs through every case on this issue.
And that's what I understood from the brief. The piece that I'm not as clear about is the discussion about the discrepancies in the testimony.
Well,
that the testimony... differed in critical respects because the testimony in the federal proceeding went to actions taken in furtherance of, which was not the case in the state proceeding, as I understood the argument today.
Right. There are different elements in a federal case, and so one of the things we needed to elicit was the fact that Montgomery knew from talking to Gardner that Gardner was motivated to commit this murder to get money to pay for a lawyer for Martin, to get Martin out of jail. This was very credible testimony, but it hadn't appeared in the state trial. The state prosecutor there had no incentive to try to elicit testimony like that. He wasn't doing a RICO case. He wasn't trying to link up Mr. Gardner to any other defendants. Mr. Martin wasn't on trial in that case.
The discrepancy then was the absence of such evidence in the state proceeding?
That's correct, Your Honors. And actually, we had another witness named Ernest Reynolds, or Ibn Reynolds, who testified to that he had had conversations with Gardner, and Gardner had told him that he committed that murder to get money to get Martin an attorney so that he could get out of jail. So it was very credible testimony, but Mr. Kurland wanted to be able to cross-examine Montgomery about that. And of course, he did cross-examine Montgomery about that at great length. He didn't elicit the punishment that Gardner had gotten in the prior trial because he wasn't allowed to, and he wasn't permitted to elicit the verdict. But he cross-examined Montgomery furiously on this point at great length and on many other points, so it really had no impact on the cross-examination of Montgomery. Mr. Kurland's whole presumption here is that Montgomery, who was a convicted murderer, knew the differences between what was needed in a federal trial and what was needed in a state trial, and was smart enough and clever enough to tailor his testimony to make federal prosecutors happy, and that he therefore made up this business about doing it to help Martin.
I think I understand your response, and I don't mean to cut you off, but I also don't want to take up all your time.
Okay.
And I would hope in the time you have remaining, if you could, you would address the defense strategy at trial of standing in concert in reciting in unison during the proceedings, and the use, and specifically the government's use of that conduct.
Okay, Your Honors, the conduct that we're talking about was disturbances in the courtroom, not a defense. We didn't attack or make use of their legal arguments. We made use of the fact that for 2.5 years, they prevented the courtroom from functioning by standing up and yelling speeches, denouncing the court, denouncing the lawyers, denouncing the government of the United States, denouncing everything in sight.
Wasn't that a defense strategy that that necessarily implicates it? It clearly wasn't a very good strategy, but why wasn't that why could they not have done that without risking its use against them? That's phrased inartfully, but I think you understand the gist of my question. And isn't that a danger? Isn't that a risky or potentially a slippery slope?
Well, as Your Honor pointed out yourself, this was evidence of their concerted activity in furtherance of the enterprise. It was therefore relevant to the government's case, and the government could seek to admit it. We didn't even have to modify the indictment to get in such evidence. In the Anderson case, which we discussed in our brief at some length and is the nearest case, the court admitted evidence of courtroom disturbances and other kinds of obstruction, reciting this mantra both during the investigative stage and during the trial. And there had been no modification of the indictment. The court simply admitted it because it was evidence of the concerted activity by the defendants and therefore relevant to the case. So the reason the defendants couldn't engage in this conduct without taking a risk is that they were giving the government relevant evidence to prove the racketeering enterprise and the racketeering conspiracy in this case.
Let me ask you this. Had there been evidence that defense attorneys had devised, not the defendants, but defense attorneys, maybe not intelligently, but had devised that as a strategy, would that change the analysis of whether or not that information could be used as evidence of concerted action? You understand my question?
I do, and I'm reflecting on how to respond. I think that there would be something like an advice of counsel defense in that case, and that the government would have been well advised not to use that evidence if it were.
Do you think the analysis would be different somewhat? The judge might well have to consider something else on letting that stand or be introduced as evidence of concerted action.
Absolutely. I do.
Given any thought to how this a rule would be articulated that allows this kind of testimony but prevents it from going so far as to suppress intelligent, purposeful defenses? But how do we fashion a rule that says this conduct's okay and yet protect defendants and defense lawyers from their strategies?
I think the distinction here is simply one between a legal defense, which of course the defense is completely entitled to maintain, and disturbing the courtroom proceedings to the point where the court can't function, which happened in this case for 2.25 years.
But what the information was not used to highlight the disruptiveness of the behavior. It was used as an element or as indication of concerted action, which was at issue.
It was concerted action to obstruct justice, to disrupt the proceedings in court and to thwart the prosecution. So I think it was both of those things, Your Honor. It certainly was concerted action, and the scripts were identical. Each defendant would get up and give the same script each time. So it, had they done only that without disrupting the courtroom activities and without preventing the court from functioning, then we wouldn't have sought to use it. They could have engaged in concerted conduct that would have been lawful. But this was concerted conduct that prevented the court from functioning, that obstructed justice.
So you would cabin, you would say that it can be used if it's concerted activity that has an impermissible purpose, even if that impermissible purpose is the strategy.
A concerted legal defense is not something we would ever have sought to use in evidence. All we sought to use in evidence was concerted obstruction of justice. And that's the distinction we operated on. That's what the...
Well, why is it that it is obstruction of justice that keys its admissibility? I mean, what would prevent, you know, you from saying a consistent defense? In fact, all four of them are using the same defense as evidence of their continuing conspiracy.
Actually, I think that goes to the point Judge Shedd raised about the possibility that the lawyers could have been in on the concerted legal defense part of, they all often are on in on a concerted legal defense in a case, and we would.
If they're obstructing justice, or they're not obstructing, or they're doing something that reflects concerted effort that doesn't obstruct justice, that's still evidence of conspiracy. Why is it that obstructing it becomes admissible testimony for the government, but then somehow non-obstructive conduct?
I think a conspiracy requires not only concerted action, but a criminal goal. A conspiracy is an agreement to do something unlawful, by definition, and that's the instruction that district courts give jurors all the time. But a conspiracy or an agreement to do something legal, like mount a legal defense, is not a conspiracy within the meaning of the law, and we would have never sought to use that as evidence.
What if we had evidence that at the jailhouse, defendants were passing notes, defendants in a RICO action were passing notes, which they were each encouraging each other to lie? That would be concerted activity, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
Do you think that would be obstruction of justice to lie?
Yes, I do.
Okay. What about that? What if there was concerted effort just to drag out and to be as non-responsive as possible, which is not perjury, not obstruction of justice, but they just, as a strategy in jail, they pass notes on the lunch trays to one another. This is what we propose doing. Let's all agree just to take as long as we possibly can. Ask the question to be asked three or four times before you answer. You think that would be appropriate evidence, do you not, of concerted activity?
To simply drag things out?
Yeah, but that's the goal of it. But it's concerted activity to achieve that goal, which is not obstruction of justice.
Well,
don't you would say you thought maybe you could offer that.
I would be. That would be much less good evidence for us because
there's
a fine line between drawing things out and obstructing justice.
Right? No, not for concerted activity. I'm trying to get to the point that the chief judge asked you. That's concerted activity that didn't have anything to do with obstruction of justice. He's asking where the defining point is. I thought you would say, of course, the judge sits and decides what's going to be allowed and all that, but why wouldn't you argue that was concerted activity?
Because, as I said before, I think it has to be concerted activity toward an unlawful end. And whether or not delaying
Why do you say that? What does it have to be? Not everything that they do in the RICO, not everything they do in concerted activity is necessarily toward an unlawful end at that point, is it? Sure, in a RICO prosecution, you'd have concerted activity toward an unlawful end, but don't you also just have other periods of concerted activity, which indicates at least they know how to and can act together in concert? Or you think that's not relevant?
Well, it may be relevant,
right?
But there is the need to respect the defense right to mount their own defense. And
What's that got to do with people, not defense lawyers being involved in it, just the defendant saying, if you're going to get convicted, let's make it happen in December rather than May, and let's just drag this thing out as long as we can. Isn't that proof? Wouldn't that not be proof of concerted activity?
It would be proof of concerted activity, Your Honor, but I think any prudent prosecutor would feel the need to respect defendants' rights to mount their own kind of defense.
But
if it were obstruction of justice, if it rose to the level of obstruction of justice, then of course we would use it. It all depends on how they go about dragging things out. In the
so you suggest the dividing line is obstruction of justice?
Yes, I believe that the dividing line is whether or not the concerted activity is lawful or unlawful.
What about the Freeman? And I ask about them because my recollection is they honestly believe that the court has no jurisdiction over them. So if several Freeman were indicted for conspiracy and they came in and all of them stood up and said the same thing and objected to the jurisdiction of the court as a result of honest belief the court has no jurisdiction on them, you could use that as evidence against them in a conspiracy charge or RICO charge.
Well, again, the hypothetical involves concerted activity, and it's therefore relevant. But in my view, it's relevant only if it's directed toward an unlawful end. So if it's obstruction.
Your definition would be as an unlawful end.
Obstructing the court, preventing the courtroom from functioning.
Mm-hmm. Because they honestly believe the court has no jurisdiction over it.
Would it matter if it were a conspiracy? Would it matter whether they did it in furtherance of a conspiracy? The issue here is the concerted nature of the what you were using the activity to demonstrate was the acting in concert. Would that make a difference?
I'm sorry.
With the Freeman example, I don't know whether it would be a RICO conspiracy or not, but would it matter for purposes of the Stratus hypothetical whether one of the things you were trying to show was acting in concert?
Yes, it would. I think that because this was a conspiracy case and because we were required to show concerted action, that made it relevant. If it were a trial of a single defendant, say, as in the Wright case that the defense relies on inappropriately.
But I thought Judge Batchelor asked you if several people came in. He said if you were trying several Freeman and they all stood up with an honest belief, court had no jurisdiction over them. They all got up and said it is a conspiracy case, and they all said the same thing because that's what they all independently believe. That's one reason they hang together in the Freeman. That's what they believe. He's just asking, in that conspiracy case, would that be evidence of some kind of agreement?
Yes, of course it would. It would be evidence of an agreement. Whether or not the government should seek to introduce it would depend.
Well, listen, let me ask you this much. I just asked you earlier. You said it had to. You didn't say whether or not the government seeks to use it. You said the government should only seek to use it if it leads to an unlawful end. That's what you said.
That's right.
I was trying to get away from your discretion. I was going to ask you, was that a question of your discretion when you answered my question or not? I didn't have to get there because you actually gave me a bright line rule. If it leads to unlawful or the effort is unlawful activity, a lawful end, it is permitted. So even with the honest belief, if they just stood up and said, three said it all at the same time, shouted out, you have no jurisdiction over it. You can't try us. That could then be used by you as evidence in their conspiracy case.
If that's all they did, I would say not.
Why not?
Because it doesn't disrupt the activities in the courtroom.
But they stood up and said it in the courtroom.
Well, I mean, it doesn't impede the court from functioning. If they only say it once, the question is, what these guys
say it the second day they come. That's at the preliminary hearing. Then the first day in front of the jury selection, the jury's not called in yet. Pre-trial, pre-jury selection motions, they stand up and say the second time.
It's a question of whether they spend hours doing that or seconds doing that.
All right, let's presume hours.
If it's hours, then it might be every chance
they get. Every time that jury walks in, they stand up and say, you can't try us, you have no jurisdiction. This court has no jurisdiction of us. We have independent rights as American citizens. We can't do this. Every time the jury comes in.
Okay, then that might rise to obstruction of justice, in my opinion.
So you still go, you hang it on obstruction of justice or some other unlawful end?
Yes, I do.
Let me ask you this, just to belabor this. What if the judge said, the first time they do it, the judge goes, I am not going to brook that in my courtroom. Each of you understand, no more outbursts, period. You've made your point. I'll let you make that point again outside the presence of the jury, but you're not to do it ever again in my courtroom in the presence of the jury. And they do it again in the presence, one time in the presence of the jury. Is that usable? Is that obstruction of justice? Violating the court's order, administration of justice, is that?
That makes it much worse, and I think it might. It would be contempt of court in that case. They'd be violating a direct order from the judge, and so.
Well, it wouldn't be contempt of court because the judge doesn't necessarily have to rule on contempt. He hadn't ruled on contempt of court. He didn't hold them in contempt. He just told them not to do it, and they did it. Usable or not, under your analysis?
You said in your hypothetical that they were doing this in front of the jury.
They did. After the judge told them, they did it outside the presence of the jury. The judge told them and heard them and said, that's enough now. I'm telling you, you're wrong. You've made your point. I don't ever do that again in this courtroom during this proceeding. Subject to contempt, but don't ever do that in front of the jury. And they do it in front of the jury one time. Is that obstruction of justice enough to allow the testimony about their concerted activity?
Yes, but at that point, I think it may well be, but that at that point, the testimony is in front of the jury because they've heard the outburst. It doesn't have to be admitted into evidence.
Yeah, but could you argue that? You think you could rightfully argue that to the jury? Just because something shows in front of the jury doesn't mean that necessarily is appropriately argued to the jury. You could argue that concerted activity to the jury?
Well, I wouldn't want to go. I would be very careful because of what happened in the Wright case where you recall that's the case where the...
I'm just asking you, what do you think? Could you argue that to the jury or not?
I'd be very careful about doing that. I'd be very cautious about doing that.
The answer would be yes or no. I'm just wondering.
I'd probably say no.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Harding.
Thank you, Your argument. Honor. Very
Lawler.
Interesting discussion.
Thank you. Mr. Lawler.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have a few brief points. Initially, and I apologize, I probably should have said this in my opening remarks, but I think there's a very full discussion of this issue in the joint appendix, beginning at page 1844, where after the government rested, at which time the sort of rubber had hit the road, the witness was available and was in court, we pressed Judge Davis for a final discussion and a final ruling, and the discussion went on between the judge and the government to some degree, and mainly defense counsel about this choice, if you will. And at that time, it was clear, I think, the purpose, why we wanted to call this witness, that we wanted the juror excluded if we were going to be forced into a choice between the juror and the witness, and that we weren't going to be satisfied with a proffer or an affidavit. Now, this testimony, I would submit to the court, is not an alibi. I don't know how one presents an alibi to a 12-year conspiracy charge other than to say I was, you know, out of the country for 12 years. This was a gentleman who obviously lived in Baltimore. The defense in this case was, through the conspiratorial charges, that this wasn't, number one, a racketeering enterprise, and that this wasn't a conspiracy at all, and it certainly wasn't the conspiracy that the government alleged it was.
What was it? What specifically was it relevant to? Because as I understood it, it was never alleged that criminal activity took place during that period.
It was relevant to show, that, and this is what we argued in closing argument, that this was, at its best day, multiple conspiracies. That the four defendants came together from time to time over a period of 12 years and occasionally engaged in criminal activity, but the notion that there was an enterprise, A, or B, that this was one conspiracy that spanned 12 years was incorrect.
But there was no, apart from the fact that there was no, apparently there was no, as you acknowledge, criminal activity alleged during that period, there were other people who could show, who could and did testify to the fact of Mr. Mitchell's presence at Hickey during the relevant time. If that's all, I mean, if you simply want to indicate that there was a community there at the time.
It wasn't just that he was there, though, Your Honor. There was evidence in this case, for example, that while the defendants or some of the defendants were housed at Supermax, they had access to cellular telephones. This would have been testimony about what he was doing during an 11-month period at the very inception of the conspiracy to show that this gentleman was not just there, but that he was law-abiding during a substantial point of the conspiracy.
When he was present.
When he was present at Hickey for 11 months. One final point, Your Honor, I realize my time is up.
No, I don't mean for 11 months. I meant present when he was at Hickey.
Correct. Correct. And the final point, Your Honor, the government says that we were offered an affidavit. Both the government and the court wanted the affidavit to exclude the name of the witness. I would consider that evidence to be really thin in a case of this magnitude and a pale substitute for the testimony of the witness.
Thank you, Mr. Lawler. Mr. Flannery?
Thank you. Just a couple of points. I think that Mr. Harding's inability to articulate exactly when the government may use conduct that was used in this case or may use pleadings that were used in this case and when they wouldn't demonstrates the risk involved in allowing the government to have that determination of when
he gave us in this case as an example of when it clearly is. We just were looking for a more specific divining line. That didn't mean he's not able to support what happened in this case.
What I would like to comment on is I still think that the risk involved in allowing the government to do what they did here is apparent in the sense that Mr. Harding talked about 2.5 years of disrupting courtroom proceedings, but what he didn't mention was that there was, between the initial indictment and when the appellants had adopted this defense, there was 20 months of appropriate dignity in the courtroom. So to characterize it as a continuation of a conspiracy from the initial indictment was a stretch. I mean, Judge Davis recognized that dignity that the appellants conducted themselves before they adopted the defense. The other thing I would like to just point out, too, is that in the Anderson case...
Is there any evidence at all that defense counsel in any way advised or suggested that the defendant should do that?
No, absolutely not. In fact, I mean, not only did they not advise, but there were times when they clearly would not cooperate with counsel, so certainly not. But I do think that it does go to show that in a case like this, if what the government did here is allowed to continue, it demonstrates what defense counsel in the future would, in fact, advise clients to be very wary of what you do post-indictment in furtherance of whatever defense it is that you choose to mount. And
that would be bad because?
because it has a chilling effect on defendants and on defendants.
Encouraging them not to do anything illegal post-indictment?
Not that it's not doing anything illegal. It'd be wary of doing anything in concert. The defendants had a right if they wanted to, for instance, even in this case. Say, perhaps at the beginning of trial, they wanted to stand up and even in an appropriate manner, tell Judge Davis once more that we do not believe that you have jurisdiction over us. We're flesh and blood men. We don't agree with these charges. We don't understand these charges. And that would have feed right into what the government had done here in an attempt to criminalize that concerted conduct. So it does have a chilling effect on the Sixth Amendment. And the other thing, too, that I would just point out very quickly is to the extent that Mr. Harding was drawing a line of when it becomes obstruction of justice, that's when it triggers a government ability to use that. That still doesn't answer the question of the pleadings and how many pleadings are required. I mean, one or two, what series? And do they have to either have no merit or some merit? And is the government going to make the determination as to what does and does not have merit? So, thank you very much.
Let me just ask this. The experience I've had with this kind of conduct is defendants have met people in the jail who convince them that this is a valid defense and a good idea, and this will help you get off, and they buy into that. The problem with this case is that this conduct has been going on for a long time. I mean, there's a clear pattern to it. So how would you respond to the fact that there's a pattern that shows that this is a concerted action and a purposeful activity?
Well, I think that in this case, to the extent that there was a pattern and it was going over the course of years, was largely probably due to the nature of, you know, the number of pretrial pleadings, the complexity of the case, the number of pretrial proceedings that had to be scheduled in this case. Now, there certainly were times where there were more than there should have been because the appellants had disrupted them, and some of them had to be canceled. But I think to the extent that there's a pattern, that's different than just concentrating on whether or not there's concertive action. I mean, there's concertive action at just even one time. And I'm not sure when a pattern develops. Maybe it's two times. You know, to the extent that there was a pattern here, I'm not sure how it necessarily changes the analysis one way or another when it was the concert of action that the government was really stressing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Flanagan.
Thank you.
Mr. Grove.
May it please the Court, I think Mr. Harding inadvertently misstated the purport of our instruction. It was not that Mr. Martin had to agree to commit the acts, but that he would have to agree that that one conspirator would commit the acts. Judge Duncan asked a question concerning the court's actual instructions, and references were made to the joint appendix at page 2150 and 2169. I touched on that in my first argument, but the difficulty is this. The court never really defined what the term pattern of racketeering acts was. The court never said that each defendant had to have agreed to the commission of two racketeering acts. Indeed, the special verdict form did not provide for any indication of that either. It just said that two racketeering acts had to be agreed to. By two people, by three people, by four people, nothing was said. What we wanted was an instruction that Mr. Martin had to have agreed to the commission of two racketeering acts. We also think that the instruction was flawed by the constant use of the phrase in some manner, that he had to have agreed to have participated in this in some manner. Obviously, he agreed to participate in some manner because of the fact that he was convicted of the drug conspiracy, which was a racketeering act, but that was only one of the racketeering acts. No case, the prosecution has cited no case which says our instruction is incorrect. Any number of cases say that it is. The O'Malley standard instructions, the Seventh Circuit standard instructions, the Eleventh Circuit standard instructions all say that it's correct. Mr. Harding also cites the Pizzonia case. Let me just read a passage from that. although no less than two predicate acts must be committed, or in the case of a RICO conspiracy, agreed to, citing another Second Circuit case, it's not the number of predicates proved, but rather the relationship that they bear to each other or to some external organizing principle, which is necessary for RICO. Of course, it is correct that a RICO involves not merely predicate acts, but there has to be continuity. What the Second Circuit doesn't say, there doesn't have to be agreement. In fact, they say there does have to be an agreement. What the Second Circuit says is that there has to be something in addition to the agreement, to the two predicate acts. Bisogno was a very bizarre case where all the predicate acts were committed before the statute of limitations expired, but the conspiracy itself persisted beyond that point. And that's the reason that the Bisogno case was making the argument that it did there.
Okay. I think you're out of time.
I have a minute and 12 seconds on mine.
Do you?
I'm over. Thank you, Your Honor.
That's okay. Thank you. Ms. Gerland, can you make it very brief?
I'll make four brief points with respect to Gardner. The first is that we just wanted to admit evidence of the guilty verdict and that Montgomery received a substantial sentencing break. We did not want to admit evidence of the sentence, first thing. Second thing was, if you look at page 161 of our opening brief, Judge Davis, at the last minute, literally when Montgomery was about to testify, he said, okay, I'll let you say trial, but you can't get the result. And I'm just
if evidence of the guilty plea had been entered, is that not setting the precondition for ineffective assistance of counsel?
Judge Shedd, no, because
that's what you're saying now, but wouldn't we be hearing that?
Judge Shedd, we made a big deal. Barry and I, Mr. Corbett and I, we thought about it. We discussed this for a long time before we decided. But ultimately, because Gardner had already been convicted in state court, unlike the other murders, and we had seen how the evidence was going to come in, our defense on this charge was that this murder was not done in furtherance of, was not done to maintain or increase his position. And it was our decision that the focus on that element was critical. It was not.
I know what your focus was, but I find it hard to believe that that would not open the door for somebody to claim ineffective assistance of counsel, because you insisted on putting in front of the jury that he was guilty of murdering somebody.
But Judge Shedd, no, that the jury found him guilty. We were not. We were going to put forth evidence. We didn't concede guilt.
I didn't say you did.
We were going to put forth evidence that an earlier jury had found him guilty.
Right.
But on the critical issue, though, because
I understand what you say. That's why it makes.
All right. The government changes its position, though. At court, that was ultimately the grounds that Judge Davis kept the evidence out. The government now claims that there's some sort of subversive jury nullification claim going. They've done a total 180. They now think that if we would have gotten that before the jury would have acquitted because of some sort of, we're not going to convict.
I know, that was in that trial. I'm talking about after the fact, when somebody looks back at this case, and that a defense lawyer insisted on putting in front of the jury that his client was convicted of murder. That's I understand why you did it in an articulate, maybe informed reason, but I'm telling
you. Right. Judge Shedd, we discussed it. That's talked about.
Stan, I've got that point.
Right.
I probably used up all but maybe 15 seconds of your time.
A couple of quick things, though. the other one was on that with respect to changing it at the last minute when he said we can do it. The judge even says the court acknowledged, this is 161 on our opening brief, the court acknowledged that it's a modified ruling. The court recognized this 11th-hour modification was harmful to the defense. The court acknowledged that the modified ruling put Gardner in even more of a, quote, box, leaving open the inference that maybe Gardner was tried and acquitted in the prior trial. And that would have been even more damaging to us because the jury would have said, we got to convict this guy now here because there was this earlier proceeding and he was acquitted.
Absolutely cuts both ways.
Well, but see, that's why it's a defense. The evidence was relevant under Rule 403, and there's no valid legal ground to keep it out unless Judge Shedd's position would prevail that somehow it was ineffective assistance of counsel. But I think in the cold light of day in the analysis, given that we got acquittals on 5 of the 11 counts, and the evidence with respect to his involvement, not that his involvement in the homicide was fairly overwhelming, the only defense on the federal charge was that his involvement in the Spence homicide was not undertaken to maintain or increase his position in the enterprise. That was the only defense, Judge Shedd. and we got acquittals on all of the other murders. So the government goes through all this problem, all these issues, and our client comes out ultimately not.
What was it ruled out under? What rule was it not admitted?
The judge ultimately ruled that if you look at the record, Judge Shedd, you're absolutely correct. The judge's ultimate conclusion was that I'm not going to admit it unless Gardner on the
under
record.
Under what rule was it?
He said that to save him from a fair trial, unless Gardner on the record would assent. And he asked, and there was a colloquy asking, Mr. Gardner, do you assent? And he goes, for value, ACC, not ACC, UCC, so on and so forth. And as we point out in the brief, Judge Shedd, there are a handful of positions on issues.
I understand.
The one last thing, and I know I'm out of time, but let me just emphasize.
Way out of time, man.
The one last thing.
Just be glad the Chief Judge is. Chief Judge is
right. Chief Judge Traxler, thank you very much. Mr. Harding pointed out that he claims that the discrepancy was the absence of evidence, and this goes to a point that Judge Duncan raised. That is incorrect. That there was a fundamental difference between, Mr. Harding made an argument that, well, the state prosecutor didn't need to go into this, but it was 180 degrees different from Holly recruits Gardner because Gardner needs to be involved to lose money, as opposed to this is all involved because we have to raise legal fees for Martin and because this is our plan B to kill and rob somebody because the goose thing didn't take place.
Okay.
Members of the panel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Curlin. We'll come down and greet counsel.